Hello everyone, and welcome to this session organised jointly by the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the Chartered Institute of Taxation on the changing world of work. And it's an incredibly hot topic. Only today there was another legal case involving Addison Lee, fueling all the controversy that we've had in recent months about the rights of the gig economy and the precariat of workers. And there's also been a lot in recent months about tax as well, you know, the Chancellor's U-turn, worries about the sheer scale of the costs of the growing numbers of self-employed on the economy. And this summer we also had the Taylor Review, so we've got lots to talk about and a very expert panel. Peter Dowd is a former social worker who was heavily involved in local politics before going to being elected to Westminster in 2015, and he became Chad Chief Secretary in February this year. Kate Bell is Head of Economics and Social Affairs at the TUC and has had a long varied history working for Child Poverty Action Group, Gingerbread, Ed Miliband, and local authority. And Helen Miller joined the Institute for Fiscal Studies straight from university with a very stellar degree in economics, and you've worked there ever since, except for a short stint at Bank of England. And she's done a lot of work on the topic that we're here today, and she doesn't pull her punches about it, I can tell you that. And John Cullinane is the Tax Policy Director for Chartered Institute, which he joined after a long career at Deloitte, and he's really pleased to be here because when he joined, he said that one of the things he most wanted to do was bring the debate about tax to politicians. So, we've got a lot to talk about, and the order's going to be, Helen's going to talk, and then Peter. Peter needs to go at about 6:15, so we're going to have some questions to Peter after that, and then we'll have the other speakers. But do you want to kick off?
Absolutely, great. I'm going to stand up so I can see all of you, but if any point you can't hear me, wave them in, I'll use a microphone. So as Vanessa just said, there's been lots of talk in the recent year about the changing world of work. And when you look at the data, that's not at all surprising. So it's not the chart I thought I was going to see. So this is showing the labour market. The point this is trying to make was that 85% of the workforce are still employees. So actually there hasn't been a radical change in the sense that the shape is broadly similar. But when you zoom in, you see that 40% of the workforce growth since 2008 has come from people working for their own businesses, either through self-employment and owner-managers. Now, you can dig around in this data and see lots of other interesting stuff. I'm going to just highlight one thing, which is that this isn't all the gig economy. That's part of it, and part of this is to do with the change in technologies. But so actually, some of these trends, so for example, the growth in owner-managers has been happening since at least the 1990s. So they've been outstripping employment growth for quite a while. So there is something new about this, in that the growth has picked up, but we're not just seeing the effects of the gig economy. So what I'm going to do today is focus just on how the tax system interacts with this, because I don't think you can understand what's going on in the labour market without understanding the tax system. And I think one of the best answers to the question of what can the government do to try to deal with the new gig economy is fix the tax system. So to give you a big, kind of a high-level overview of what the tax system is doing, I want to show you this, which is an example of a how much tax you would pay on a job that generates £40,000, depending on the legal form you choose. So take a lawyer or an accountant, they can do their job through employment, self-employment, or being a company owner-manager. They're going to earn £40,000. You can already see here that there's a really big tax penalty on employment. So if you do your work through employment, you're getting a tax, relative to being a company owner-manager, your tax bill is 40% higher. That's a really big difference. So part of what we're seeing in the labour market is because the tax system is nudging people out of employment and into running their own businesses. And we know this has an effect on people's behaviour. I mean, there's lots of examples of that, and you can see it very clearly in the data. But we know it affects both how they choose to take their income and what kind of legal form they choose to have. And actually some of the big cases we've seen in the press recently are all to do with, you know, basically this. Why are we seeing people who are workers in employment law and taxed under self-employment? It's because of these tax differences. So one reason to care is because it's creating these inefficiencies in the labour market. We don't want the tax system to be making people choose self-employment for tax purposes. We want them to be choosing it because it's the best legal form for them. It also clearly raises concerns about fairness, in the sense that you can have similar individuals earning similar incomes getting really big tax differences. And even if you didn't care about those two things, it lower rates for these two groups. And to give some sense of scale, that equates to a tax subsidy of about £1,200 for a self-employed person and about £9,000 for a company owner manager. But I think the question here is, if the government is willing to give an £11 billion tax break to a certain group, why shouldn't employees be able to share in this, or why shouldn't it be better targeted a group we might think about wanting to help? Now, these tax differences aren't new, and in fact, in the past, they've been worse. And there's a couple of reasons why they're coming to light now, one of which is that because of this rapid growth in people running their own businesses, the OBR have calculated how much that's going to cost in revenue, and they recently downgraded their revenue forecast for the end of the parliament by £4.5 billion. So even if you are willing to ignore these differences, because they've long been in the system, you now have to do something. We have to submit about this. We either have to fix the problem, or raise money elsewhere, or cut spending, or increase borrowing. But you know, something is going to have to be done. I mean, the other reason it's come to light is because people are starting to see the problems that tax differences are causing. So IFS have been banging on about this for years. But I think it's now, you tell people that the tax system matters, and they think, oh, maybe it does. But now you're seeing, you know, really concrete examples of the gig economy of people who are self-employed, but not because they're entrepreneurial or because it's good for them or they're making a free choice, but because actually, you know, the tax system is pushing them into that employment form when actually they might be better off being employees. So I think those examples have brought this to light. And as, you know, Vanessa said, Matthew Taylor had his review this summer, and he, you know, despite the fact that tax wasn't part of his big mandate, he also agreed that these tax incentives across legal forms aren't justified or sustainable, and they're not conducive to a good world of work. So what I'm going to do in a few slides' time is sketch out what I think we do need to do to the tax system to make it conducive to a good world of work. But I wanted to pick up quickly on this point about not being justified. So all I've told you so far is that there are big tax differences, that they're expensive and that they're unfair, but they've been around for a long time. So there are costs to doing this. But if you thought there were benefits, that they were justified in some way, you might be willing to live with these tax differences. So what I'm going to do very quickly is run through the three main arguments put forward in defence of these tax differences and argue that none of them work as a good justification. So, these aren't the slides I thought I was going to show you. So, okay, this is the tax difference for, this is a national insurance schedule. This is another way of showing you the graph I showed you earlier. And you can see that the entire difference between, you know, employment and self-employment is driven by national insurance contributions. So we put employer NICs on work that happens through employment, but not on work that happens through self-employment. And there's a big gap. So to make that idea concrete, the effective rate for a self-employed person is 9%. For an employee, it's 22.7%. So there's these big differences. So you might think that these differences... This is not the graph I thought I was going to show you, so I'll come back to that graph. You might think these big differences are justified by saying, well, yes, self-employed get these lower tax rates, but they also get lower access to publicly funded benefits. Now, it's true, that might be a rationale, but in practice now, the self-employed get access to very similar state benefits. The big difference was pensions, that's no longer true. There's only two differences, and it's now the contribution-based JSA and some parental benefits. And although they're important to the individuals getting them, and we should think about whether self-employed people can extend their rights to them, these are tiny in revenue terms, and you can't justify anything like that gap I just showed you. I mean, to give you context, if we wanted to justify a gap, we'd be arguing about whether their rate should be 22.4 or 22.5, not whether it should be 9. So we're in the wrong ballpark for that. Second reason it's often put forward is that, well, employees get employment rights, and therefore they should have higher taxes to offset that. This, I understand, is a compelling argument, but it's just logically flawed. I think the way to understand that is to realise that unlike publicly funded benefits, which are a benefit that the government gives to employees, employment rights are a transfer from employers to their employees. And that subtle sounding difference turns out to matter really quite a lot. And I think one way to see that is to think about what employment rights are doing. So employment rights make employment more attractive to the employee. So I now am more likely to want to work at IFS than be a freelancer because I get some nice employment rights. And you can kind of see a higher tax rate on employment as sort of offsetting that. So far, so good. But then think about what happens on the other side of the market. Employment, for employers, employment rights now make employment less attractive because I have to provide all these employment rights. And a higher tax reinforces that effect. So now you have, and this is what we're seeing in the gig economy right now, you have employers who are saying, I already wasn't keen on employment because it comes to employment rights, and now you give me a tax reason to also no net benefit to employees. It's happening on both sides of the market. There is nothing for the tax system to offset. So when we try to offset this stuff, all we're doing is making the world worse by pushing people out of employment. And the final reason I put forward is that, well, we have these lower rates to boost entrepreneurship and encourage growth. Lots of things to say there, but the first one is that the difficulty and risk associated with running your own business doesn't in and of itself justify a lower tax rate. And in fact, we really don't want the tax system to be making people take bad risks. There are plenty of bad risks and bad business ideas, and we should not be pushing people towards them. What we have to think about is, if we do want to support something, what is it we really want to support? Is it innovation? Is it startups? Is it investment? Is it something to do with low incomes? Whatever the answer to that question is, there is a better way to do it than these current and across-the-board lower tax rates. So we should get better at targeting that. So, conclusion to what I've just said, I think it's very hard to think of a coherent policy aim to which the current system is the appropriate response. I think we really have to do better. Now, I'm going to just flip back to these answers to show you the picture I was going to show you earlier, to acknowledge that this is clearly a tough problem. This is what the Chancellor tried to do in the budget. We all know about this. You can see that it was only really touching the edges of what is really a much bigger gap. And it had to be U-turned. Now, part of that, because it was unpopular for a whole bunch of reasons. But I think part of that is because of a misunderstanding about who was really, being affected by this policy. I'm going to come here. People are worrying about, stereotypical white van men. They're kind of round here. And we're talking about, you have to really find where the tax difference is here. The big tax difference is up here. So they can think of pots and law firms or accountants. And for them, they would have seen a tax loss of about £600, which is significant. But that's in a context of some of these guys getting a benefit currently relative to employees of over £7,000. So I think that, if we think that the current self-employed rate mix regime is helping low-income people, it's not really. If we want to help low-income people, there are much, much better targeted ways to do it. For example, looking at things like changing universal credit rules, which really are going to affect low-income. So I think part of why we didn't see change is because of a misunderstanding about who was benefiting. So then let me finish quickly on what I would do with this. So I've said that I don't like these differences across tax legal forms because they're unfair, they're inefficient, and most importantly, they're not justified. So what we've tended to do today is say, well, let's just shore up the boundaries, let's put more anti-avoidance rules in to stop people switching across them. But I think that's doomed to fail, because you're never going to be able to stop people genuinely changing their behaviour. And since these boundaries aren't justified, why bother shoring them up? We should just get rid of them. So what I think we need to do is align the treatment of employees, self-employed and owner-managers, by which I mean, if you earn an extra pound of income, I don't care how you earn it, you should be taxed at the same effective marginal rate. Now, in that world, we would worry about disincentives to invest for small businesses, but we should deal with that through the tax base, not through tax rates. Then let me finish on one good piece of news. I think we could change the tax system, but it's hard. One very concrete good piece of news. Currently, and I think we'll come back in the debate to this, there are clearly big issues around employment rights. And currently, they're all muddled in together with tax and employment rights issues. And that's for historic reasons. But once we realise they don't need to be together, we can design tax policy to do what tax is good at doing, and we can design employment rights policy to do what that's good at doing, I think our challenge will become much more manageable. So we can separate these two things, design our policy appropriately, and I think the world gets much easier. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. I thought long and hard about this and sort of tried to make this as non-party political as possible, because I don't think this is the environment to do it in. So thanks for the invitation tonight from the Chartered Institute of Taxation, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I was on the TV with Paul Johnson a little bit earlier on in relation to a matter. Look, the changes we've seen in the world of work and the changes that are still yet to come are unimagined, and they are one of the great policy challenges of our time. And I also acknowledge that the significant upside from people choosing to set up their own businesses, giving themselves freedom, creating growth and potentially expanding to create other jobs in the future. question I ask, is it credible to suggest that, for example, thousands of delivery drivers have spontaneously decided to start their own businesses overnight in place of employee status? And I don't think that is credible. And the vitality which self-employed people bring to the economy is central to Britain's success. And it should be done for the right reasons in the right circumstances, not because people have been driven down a particular path. But of course, it's not the role of the government just to cheerlead for more jobs willy-nilly, whatever they might be. There has to be some qualitative element to that. And it's not just about the quantity. And so it's those challenges I wanted to focus on most. For those not choosing to be self-employed, those in false or contrived self-employment, and for those who are genuinely in business too. Some of the new means of facilitating alternative working practices have brought cheaper prices and greater flexibility to consumers, and similar flexibilities that have been welcomed by some workers. Becoming a self-employed lawyer in a virtual law firm may suit experienced practitioners who are able to drive their own business and cope with variable income. But stripping out the sharing of social costs of employment is a less helpful prospect for workers starting a family or young graduates seeking training to enter their profession. And of course, the Transport for London and Uber have done their best to give us an interesting talking point for this evening's discussion. But whilst the regulator stepped in on the basis of legitimate concerns about passenger safety and regulatory standards, a regulatory intervention would not have been possible to address the concerns raised by many in our party and in trade unions and others about the undermining of hard-won standards for Uber's workforce. But I think we can get waylaid when dealing with new platforms like Uber by the dazzling excitement of the latest app and the never-slowing pace of the digital revolution. There's much new in the scenarios that technological change has thrown up. I don't think there's any question about that. The level of control which an app can wield over a seemingly self-employed worker could not have been in the minds of generations of judges who developed our definition of employment. But it is not digitised exploitation which has prevented the existence of a truly effective regulatory workplace standards. Too often, we think that because a company is new and exciting, it means that all its practices are in innovation, and that necessarily isn't the case. So whilst technology may facilitate an updated way of carrying out a particular practice, the reality is very often a case of putting old wine into new skins. I mean, let's not forget, we have been here before. In the immediate wake of World War II, the insecurity, low pay, poor conditions faced by many dockers, for example, as a result of a casualised employment market dominated by dock employers, led to the creation of the National Dock Labour System to ensure improved common standards for workers and cool fractious labour relations in the industry. They came back eventually, but nevertheless, that was a factor. In construction, trade unions spent much of the 20th century building up a system of common terms and conditions, training and rights through collective bargaining in an industry with a long history of being synonymous with pretty poor workplace standards, dominated by short-term fragmented workplaces, and the whole concept of health and safety, much of it targeted at the construction industry, in fact, because of the nature of the work. And the systematic trade unionism, I have to say, in construction has blown holes in much of what was built up over those years. But then there are lessons to be learned from that environment, for example, such as the system of holiday stamps, which allowed many construction workers to carry their holiday pay between workplaces, even where the nature of the work meant that there was rarely time to build up significant holiday time on a single project. And I draw attention to these, not because they are perfect solutions to the challenges we face today, but to demonstrate that we are not the first generation to face the challenges of working practice that don't seem to present neat solutions to our policy aims. And I think you've alluded to that to some extent. So to repeat, you know, we have been here before to some degree or another. And of course, as you might expect from me, the effect on the exchequer and the increasing difficulty in taxing income from work is a challenge and a tax is taxing to me in itself. So earlier this year, we saw an attempt by the government to address, again, as you've alluded to, some of the differences in how people of different working stages are taxed. And from the outset, we did oppose it, that attempt to increase national insurance contributions for low and middle income self-employed workers. And I know that my gracious hosts tonight didn't necessarily agree with that. But the point for me, despite the fact it was a breach with the Conservative Party's manifesto in relation to maximum rates of income tax and all that sort of stuff, I think more importantly for me for tonight, it was not a genuine attempt at reforming the disparities between taxation and different modes of work. And you can't fix a chaotic system by targeting just one of its aspects. And I think that goes to things like the 1,400 tax reliefs that we have as well. And there's a wider issue here as well. You know, self-employed workers can't expect to jump to the same national insurance rates as employees before their more limited rights are addressed, notwithstanding the points that you made. And it's not just about the entitlements that they enjoy, but it's this environment as part of our sort of social system, and of course the increased precariousness that they have. So increasing national insurance contribution for self-employed work has made little sense on its own when the bigger incentives for moves away from employed status is not the small national insurance savings to the worker, but the much larger national insurance savings which increase to the employer. And I've got story after story about people being driven to self-employment from employers with copper-bottomed state guarantees of their contracts, and that savings on national insurance contributions does not come back to the contracting state organisation like the NHS, and I'm happy to give an example of that. And I think Taylor has been thought to be a recognition that problems of our changing world of work must be comprehensively addressed and not approached in a piecemeal fashion. And when it arrived, there of course remains, understandably, many unanswered questions and opportunities that might have been missed in it. But anyway, that's by the by. And we don't pretend to have the solution to every question that will be thrown up in the future, but our manifesto, we try to set out a comprehensive vision of rights at work for all types of workers, a commitment to developing workable solutions to the challenges that less stable employment relationships may inevitably continue to present in the future. The introduction, for example, of a Ministry of Labour will give the government the impetus to answer the questions at the heart of the employment relationship and the tools to promote and enforce rights, whatever their status. And I think too often employers, employees and self-employed workers struggle with the legal complexities of their status and relationship, and that's a factor that has to be taken into account. The state, the government, should do more to give guidance to the vast majority of businesses, especially small businesses, who merely want to do the right thing and follow the rules. Introducing the presumption of employment status in direct worker-engaged relationships will end the ambiguity for workers, employers and HMRC while allowing genuinely self-employed people to easily establish their true status. And of course the next Labour government, I hope, will extend entitlements such as parental rights to workers of all statuses to end the impossible decisions that self-employed workers face when starting a family, sectoral collective bargaining and perhaps access to trade unions for all workers will help to create a level playing field across different employment statuses. And of course we will establish a commission to modernise the law on employment status, ensuring that a clear definition meets the needs of the modern workplace and removes the confusion which can too often result in litigation. So the solutions, finally, to the conundrums of the modern workplace are not all straightforward, but they will never be solved without an active government committed to solving them. And I hope that we will work to create an employment market which does work for as many as we possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now questions for Peter. I could just ask you, you said your manifesto will address the point about the rights of workers. What do you think about this tax issue? Would you at the same time consider sort of trying to equalise this discrepancy in the way people are taxed?
I mean, in short, yes. I think, as I tried to allude to in the presentation, albeit not PowerPoint, we have to tackle a whole range of issues. So I just think tackling one, fine, might go some way. Tackling two, I think there has to be a much more comprehensive approach to the whole question, to be quite honest. And I think the point you made about sort of you can have maybe employment rights here and the question about, you know, pay, employment status there, it's a moot point. I think that they have to be dealt with, in a sense, collectively. I think they have to be dealt with, in my view, in our view, in a much more systematic way, which is not to say you weren't suggesting that, I'm not saying that, but I think we really have to have a comprehensive approach to it, frankly.
And anybody in the panel, would you like to address anything to Gordon Leeds?
Well, actually, the IFS and ourselves, as well as the Institute for Government, published a report called Better Budgets in January of this year, and we catalogued a whole list of ways in which the making of tax policy could be improved in this country. But one of the big themes was that the same challenges and consultations that are normal for other areas of policy making don't apply to tax. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the scope of the Matthew Taylor review excluded tax, even though he said it was ridiculous and practically every commentator said it was ridiculous. So I suppose we'd look for encouragement of a different approach from the Labour government, I guess.
Just on that, can I just make a comment on that? I think in relation to the finance bill that we were just in the middle of doing, we had the Ways and Means Resolutions. We had the Ways and Means Resolutions 2 weeks ago, and the week after that we had the second reading. And I think what we found, and again, I'm generally not trying to make a party political point, I'm generally not, but what we had, which touches on your point, we had the finance bill before the election, we agreed what we could agree, and we disagreed with other things, and eventually 75 clauses were brought back. Now, we could have got on to that pretty soon after the general election, but it took us to us coming back after the summer recess to get on to those issues, and the inability to really have a good look at it, because the Ways and Means Resolution was sandwiched in between us coming back and the Brexit debate. And then the following week, when we had the second reading, it was sandwiched in between the Brexit debate and what we call the Opposition Day debate. So the ability of us to actually challenge it and really test it out was lost. And then in relation to us trying to get evidence sessions, I've just been dismissed. There's no response to that. So I think it's the answer to the question is yes, because I think it's the whole issue of, you know, not just politicians challenging this, but the ability to actually have evidence-based days, which we did on things like, and some people were here, which we did on the Criminal Finances Bill, for example. So why wouldn't that be the same with the Finance Bill, which is all about taxation? So in short, yes, I don't think I've got anything to hide on that.
Okay. Would you like to come in here?
Sure. So one of the big differences between the taxation of the self-employed and the employed, of course, is the incidence of tax on the employer rather than the employee. And I wondered if you were starting to look at the kind of equalisation of the tax system, you might start by equalising the kind of hirer's fee rather than necessarily the narrowing that actually pretty small gap in comparative terms between the self-employed and employees themselves.
I think what they say, don't they? You'll have been here, and they'll say, I think I'll take that as a submission.
Yeah. We've got a question in the middle there.
I'm Mark Price, a delegate for Water County South East. I just want to talk about, before we talk about the large tax system, also specifically on slightly less than that, but effectively, and so you asked the question, the first thing they said was, well, we think this will drive ownership of firms, all that good behaviour. And so you asked, then asked the question, what do we cost? They were estimating, you know, about 100 million a year, roughly, they were talking about. And the first you find is, did workers take this? No. Because you can imagine that for most employees, would you give up the employment rights? Would you want to give up your sick pay, your redundancy benefits? But what you find is all the private equity firms and all the loads you can give, and it's worth about $1 billion a year now, that's basically being paid your full body revenue by those private equity firms.
Can I just make some comment? I think the issue for me is, I suggested this before in relation to 1,400 tax reliefs, and maybe colleagues would want to comment on that one. The bottom line is those 1,400 tax reliefs, I almost suspect some of them are written with a quill pen, frankly, you know, in terms of what they're supposed to do, what they weren't supposed to do, and they do what they should have done, but don't do this, that, and the other. And in a way, I think that's something that has to be looked at, because there's always a danger of us focusing on national insurance rates, or which is very important, and tax rates in this rate or that rate or the other rate, and those sorts of things get left because they're in the too difficult to do box, essentially. So I think it's trying to have a comprehensive look at it. And I think what Labour did is we got Bob Kerslake to do a report. I don't know that anyone saw this one. On the Treasury, basically, in the operation of the Treasury, a sort of root and branch look at that as a starter to lay the foundations for not a different tax system, but a more open and transparent internal process for the Inland Revenue, or for the Treasury, if you want, and also shining the light on it, really.
Thank you very much. I fear you've got to leave us, which is a shame, but could we maybe just give you a clap?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As I say, I had the audience right behind me and managed to shake them off on the ground.
I'm going to race through some of these given the time, and the fact that you'll find on quite a lot of issues there's a violent agreement. These figures are compiled on a slightly different basis from the way that IFS did it, but the big picture is pretty much the same however way you cut it. You can see that the figures on tax and national insurance for people on either in employment or self-employment on equivalent earnings is very much less in self-employment. And of course, once people have set themselves up as in business, it is then possible for them to incorporate that business, and the way the tax rules work is that you would then normally expect a further saving. So the figures of about 14,000 are coming down to something over 7,000. So you can almost halve the tax liability at different levels of income. And clearly, over half that saving, the lion's share, is the employer's national insurance, which the employer saves by taking people out of employment. So when you look at the incentives, and you know, Helen talked about the perverse incentives of having these kinds of distortions in the tax system, the one that's very, very clear and the biggest, really, is that the employer has an incentive to save national insurance by taking people off the payroll. And that also does mean, as things currently stand, that they then don't have the same employment rights. Now, when you turn to the employees, obviously, different employees may value different employment rights differently, as I suppose the gentleman was alluding to. Someone working in private equity is perhaps going to find the tax break bigger and the employment rights less. Other people will find a different balance. But from the employer's point of view, it's completely, the incentives are all working one way, which is to reduce the overall level of employment and see people in the self-employed sector. And then, of course, more money can be saved by slightly different, you know, employment laws and tax laws around this, and it's not abundantly clear. Now, traditionally it has been the case where if the employer wants to defend the position when the revenue come in to do a PAYE audit, it's much more secure for him to be able to say, well, actually, I'm not contracting with an individual, I'm contracting with a company. And therefore, that has added to the impetus over and above the actual headline figures. Now, when you look at all this all together, if it wasn't for something like Brexit, this would probably be like top of HMRC's agenda at the moment. Because Helen was giving you some of the figures, the erosion of the tax base through this is quite significant. And it's not just a question of the, again, the headline figures. It's a question of the fact that when you're in employment, relatively speaking, the money rolls into HMRC through PAYE. Compliance rates with PAYE are very, very high indeed. You know, when people go into self-employed or the incorporated sector, you're entirely dependent on people doing tax returns, going into the system. And the system is much more onerous. So that, if you like, is a kind of extra burden to the people who are in that position who are trying to be compliant. But of course, you know, a relative invitation to the unscrupulous. So this would, there is no doubt at all, this is a kind of major, major problem for HMRC. And I'm told since 2010, self-employment has risen by 20%, incorporations by a third, and single-person companies by 60%. Now, many, many aspects of that, hopefully, are the genuine growth in entrepreneurialism and so on. But again, you can't lose sight of the fact of what the tax incentives push you towards. Now, I'm going to, I'm not going to say any more about Matthew Taylor because with the previous comments and the questioning, we talked quite a lot about that. And we've also talked about the spring budget. But again, the key point is the proposals that Philip Hammond made related to employees' national insurance, which is really a very small part of the piece compared to the employer's national insurance. So what are the blue skies options for doing something about it? I think Helen was, you know, frankly propounding the view that, you know, there ought to be a level playing field, that whatever legal form in which the lawyer serves is set, you ought to be taxed at the same rate. And I think that is kind of very appealing. We are very strong opponents of the fact that there ought to be much more informed and widespread public debate about this sort of thing, because there's adopting that principle would mean really quite different levels of tax for many, many people, very significant ones. And the way in which things are done at the moment in the tax field is very much the white man ban, as Selim referred to, probably heard for the first time on news at 10, the night of the spring budget, that, you know, revenue was a bit concerned there might be a problem with imbalance in the national insurance system. In our view, there ought to be serious public blue skies debates about these sorts of the other issue, of course, is corporation tax. I mean, one of the reasons why there is this imbalance is when you go into a company, the government is driving down the rate of corporation tax because of reasons of international competitiveness. Now, it's not right to say that anybody, any government is going to be indifferent to international competitiveness. You might argue whether the rate needs to be 17 or 20 or 25, but you're talking at rates of 40 maybe to start to begin to impact on this sort of imbalance. Now, there is a tax, a dividend tax, when people take the money out of the company, but it still doesn't add up to the same amount. And there are other kind of factors in the system that when you talk about higher levels of earnings, people have the option of rolling up money in the company and then taking it out, and I think that gentleman's entrepreneur's relief at a lower rate. So all these things do interact in quite a difficult way. So that's not a kind of straightforward solution either. Other people have said, well, let's do away with national insurance and just charge a broader business social contribution on a broader range of business costs. But that, to be frank, isn't ideal either. Some of those costs, as per business rates, already bear tax. By taxing the money they're spending, some of which is hopefully going to build up the business, you're creating perhaps more of an incentive, which the ordinary profits tax acts against, to bring more of an incentive just to kind of pocket the money and not spend so much. So that's not necessarily a good incentive either. So there are difficulties with all lines of solution, which is not to say that the problem shouldn't be tackled, but to say you're going to need a lot of acquiescence by some sectors of society and public understanding before you're ever going to get a solution. Just on the last, one of the things that is of course happening, because the hemorrhage is probably too great for this not to happen, is there's more and more anti-avoidance legislation. So there's kind of tougher anti-avoidance legislation being introduced on public sector employers, which came in April, which has been very controversial by the contractor sector. I suppose the downside of this is it does make people face an adjustment very, very quickly, which is perhaps a little unfair because they're not really responsible for the kind of imbalance in the first place. But I think that kind of ramping up of anti-avoidance and maybe crystal ball gazing, will that be rolled out to larger private sector employees, is the way, frankly, one can look forward to as a default if the problem isn't solved any other way. So I think whichever solution you adopt will need much, much clearer legal definitions, because at the moment it is so vague, whether one is an employee or self-employed, that compliant people could be caught out and unscrupulous people can get away with it. That is basically the problem. Being technical people, we like to have these sort of resounding final points on the slides about our democracy is weak if we're not debating this properly. But actually, in all seriousness, I do think in a democratic society this sort of thing ought to be debated in a lot more sort of adult and thorough way than some of these kind of headlines that we saw around white man and the side of the budget. Thank you.
Thank you so much to the Institute for Fiscal Studies and to the Chartered Institute of Taxation for inviting me, and thank you very much to all of you for staying, even though the bar is actually next door, which is not a cue to leave. I'm just going to give you, this is my kind of 1 minute version of what I wanted to go through. So I think it's really important to remember that the rise of insecure work, which is what I think was the headline of this fringe event, is not just about self-employment, but it's about the rise of zero-hours contracts and insecure forms of agency. I want to say that it's not inevitable. We know that other countries are managing their labour markets in very different ways. I want to talk about why it matters, firstly for people's day-to-day experience of work, secondly for their pay and rights, and we've heard a little bit about that, also for the productivity of the wider economy, and then I just want to briefly say that tackling it is about tax, but of course it's not just about tax. And the other thing I want to say, I suppose, in introduction is I'm so pleased this issue is getting so much attention, because it's something the TUC has been working on for quite a long time, and it great to have the kind of rigorous analysis we're getting here. So here's what we tend to talk about when we talk at the TUC, talk about the growth of insecure work. And the kind of graph you can see there just shows that very sharp rise in 0 hours contracts, that's the blue line, and we always have to say there is a classification change in the way these are measured, but we don't think people could have carried on being misclassified for that long. There's about 800,000, over 800,000 people on 0 hours contracts now. You've got that sharp kind of relative flatlining of kind of temporary work, and we tend to take out people who are on a fixed term contract because that's relatively secure and just look at more like agency work. And then you've got this kind of upward rise in self-employment as well, which is the kind of grey, steady line there. And I think sometimes we think, well, are people moving from one type of insecure work to another? But if that had been happening, we think we would have seen that temporary work come down, maybe in line with the 0 hours contracts going up, or maybe in line with the self-employment going up. So actually, we think this does seem to have been a pretty big rise in the number of people doing jobs which are maybe non-standard is the best way to describe them. I think it's worth saying that the tax system actually incentivises some other types of work, as well as self-employment, some of this insecure work. And one way it very much does that is because of you only start paying national insurance as an employer, and indeed as an employee, once you're paid a certain amount. That's a big incentive to put people onto shorter hours contracts. The potential advantages for the employer of doing that is that they can avoid paying sick pay, they can avoid paying maternity and indeed paternity pay, and sometimes they can avoid the obligation to pay for workplace pension. So in fact, I haven't put the rise of short hours jobs on that graph, but often we talk to people in the retail sector, they'll tell us that, you know, this store needs 10 people, it's actually got 30 people employed, so that all of them can be on a contract in which none of them have obligations around their sick pay or around paying into the pension. So I think it's important to look at the tax system in the round, although, as Helen and John have highlighted, that disparity in self-employment is the kind of big, big wedge. Other thing I just wanted to point out is kind of how abnormal the UK situation is. And I think you guys will be very familiar with this graph, which you can't see, which has got the big chart, that light blue bar right at the end is the increase in self-employment in the UK. And when you look at our kind of different systems, it's quite difficult to think that that's not being driven by our tax system, basically. Much higher between since the financial crisis, much higher increase in self-employment in the UK than any other I think sometimes we kind of hear this kind of idea that this is all because of Uber, for example, it's all because of an app, it's all because of new forms of technology. But when we look at the jobs in which insecurity has grown most quickly, are those which have needed to be decades. So whether that's teaching, caring, or providing hospitality, those are the three industries in which insecure work is actually using the classes. I've just put a nice German comparison here. Trade unions always like to compare to Germany, which of course has a very different system, but it's not the case that we don't think it's the case that we've traded off our level of employment growth with our level of employment security. Germany had the fastest employment growth of any EU country during this period, but the proportion of people on temporary contracts and self-employment actually fell. So this is kind of a slide just saying this isn't inevitable, it shouldn't be a new normal. I just want to give you a few kind of quotes of why this matters for people's everyday lives. So this is from just a kind of online survey of TUC. I'll run through this quickly because I think most people are reasonably familiar with this. This is just showing you that there's a pay penalty for these types of jobs as well. Often we like to think that there might be a kind of trade-off between flexibility and pay. Okay, you're a bit less sure about when you're going to be paid, but you'll probably be rewarded for a trial for that. This shows that most people in these types of contracts are paid less. And then I've just highlighted some of the kind of key differences in actual employment rights and why it's the Social Security that cover these different kinds of work. So if you're self-employed, of course you're not entitled to minimum wage, you're not entitled to holiday pay, sick pay, parental benefits, often you don't qualify for, or the main forms of them, and of course you're not entitled to be enrolled into workplace pension, so it's kind of ongoing impact to you in the rest of your life. And I think one of the really interesting things about some of the cases we've seen unions take is people have only kind of realised about their employment status when something went wrong, and when they actually fell sick and needed to take a long time off sick, or when they got pregnant and said, oh, hang on, I thought I was going to get maternity pay. The worker, which is the kind of intermediate status, and maybe we won't get into a long discussion of employment status in this fringe, although we can, again, lesser rights, so no written statement of terms and conditions, protections against unfairness, we saw much more limited contractual rights. Lastly, this is a kind of slightly faint graph you can see, which is just showing the relationship between the rise of insecure work and productivity in the company. And this was from some work that we commissioned from the Learning and Work Institute to try and say, kind of, how can we explain some of these drivers behind insecure work? And we got them to look at a whole range of things. We said, can you look at investment in technology and industries and see if there's any correlation between that and the rise of insecure work? And they said, no, not really, we can't really see that. We asked them to look at profitability, and they couldn't really see any relationship there. What they did find, which is kind of interesting in the other direction, is definitely a correlation, not causation, but between lower productivity growth and higher increases in the I think it's really important to keep this in mind when we're at a stage where productivity and growth in the EU is flatlined, basically for decades, on the kind of economic level, but also on a really intuitive level. I think all of us know from our day-to-day life that if you're really kind of, if your boss is not treating you properly, if you don't know when you're going to be working, if you don't really think you're paid fairly for your job, you're probably quite likely to be less productive at work. And I think, you know, this is kind of starting to come out in the data as well as on that intuitive level. So this is my last slide, you'll be pleased to know. So we think tax is really, really important. And as I said, we're so pleased with being granted. Of course, we do think that big wage issue is the issue between the amount of tax that employers pay and the amount of tax employers pay when somebody is employed and when they're self-employed. And I think there's also some kind of interesting suggestions that came out of the Office for Tax Simplification about rolling up national insurance that you pay on your whole workforce rather than your individual workers and paying on an annual level, which might reduce some of those incentives for short hours. We'll talk about that a bit more in the discussion if you want. But of course, we think this is a complicated issue and it needs a range of solutions. It won't surprise you to know that we think top of those is workers' voice. We tend to characterise this kind of shift or kind of rise in insecure work as a shift of risk, basically, onto employers and away from employers. If you think about how do you manage kind of variable demand for your product, how do you manage whether you're going to need 20 people to come into the warehouse that day because you've had a good sales day, or three, how do you manage the fact that maybe there'll be some times when your taxi or your courier needs to stay idle. What these changes have done is basically shifted the risk of managing that onto the worker and away from the employer. And that's where we think that basically collective voice and ultimately collective power is totally vital to addressing that. I think even if you think about why this issue's got so many problems, hopefully you can see some of the role of trade unions there. We think
see that. And we also like to see a premium for non-contractual hours. And again, that's something Matthew Taylor picked up on. Quite interesting, in some American states, in Oregon, I think in parts of New York, they've started having what are called fair scheduling laws. And America, not normally thought of as kind of the bastion of left-wing labour legislation, but starting to say, actually, for kind of people in the fast food sector, they do need a minimum wage to be on shifts. And if the employer can't manage to rate them, then they should be meeting the costs of that. Lastly, again, I think to pick up this issue around the burden of proof. We think this is just a simple thing. At the moment, if you're a worker or a self-employed person or staff, basically, it can be very difficult to know what rights you have, particularly if your employer is saying, oh no, I don't think you can qualify as a sick leave. We think you should, the burden of proof should be on the employer to say, you know, you actually, this person is employed and this can really demonstrate that they're not. And lastly, again, a recommendation from the Matthew Taylor Review, one which always kind of amazes me is a law already, is that you should have a written statement on the terms and conditions.
Very much. That was absolutely fascinating. Golly, there's a lot to take in, isn't it? It's a huge area. We've got about 15 minutes, 20 minutes for questions. And really on there, everything that we've talked, we've learnt about. So can we start with the lady with the red top?
Going back to the question of the tax that is paid by someone who's employed or self-employed, are there countries who have sorted this out, and can we learn something from them?
Yes is the short answer. I mean, countries often differ in lots of reasons. I think the UK is unusually having such a big difference between how we treat self-employed people and employees. In fact, in other countries, sometimes they have the opposite. Sometimes they treat self-employed people at a higher tax level. And I think one thing that some people often find surprising is that there are other countries, the US is an example of this, where they have something like an employer-employee national insurance contribution on employees, but the self-employed just pay a higher rate of NICs. So imagine here, we just said to self-employed people, you are going to have a higher rate of NICs than employees. I think there'd be, there'd be riots. But in other countries, that is just completely standard because people realise it's just a tax on a form of work. So I think there are lots of different countries that do lots of different things who have sorted these problems out. I think one thing worth saying, which I think has come up across the different talks, is that one thing that IFS bangs on about all the time, and where I agree with Peter, is that we have to think about these things as a whole system. So let's imagine we did just sort out the gap between employees and self-employed people. That actually would be really bad if it then meant people just became incorporated small businesses. So I think we do have to think about this which is what makes it so hard, because we're talking about an issue that's really at the heart of the tax system. We're talking about how you tax income, national insurance, how you tax capital, corporation tax, and because they're clashing all together in the middle, I agree with Peter, we can't just pick one of them and adjust one rate. We have to think about them in the round. So I think we can't just take an off-the-shelf solution for one bit of the system from another country, because they differ in lots of other ways as well. But there are certainly, we know there are solutions to these problems if we could find the political will to put them in.
And John or Kate?
Well, just one sort of rider on that. There is one aspect we haven't covered so far, which is in the UK there's an extremely high VAT threshold. So if you take something like the Uber situation, obviously an individual driver might expect to be below the VAT threshold, whereas the whole organisation would be above it. So characterising the position as self-employment takes the VAT out as well. And we probably are unique in having an extremely high VAT threshold. We've had the highest VAT threshold that the EU has allowed, and you'll quite often see in the papers people say, well, now we're coming out of the EU, couldn't we have an even higher VAT threshold? But that is actually sort of adding to this, distorted behaviour.
Okay. I just wanted to actually pick up on the point that John made earlier about the way we make tax policy in this country is often really, really weird. There's loads of really tricky policy questions, but normally we don't treat them like, oh, it's impossible, it's tax, it's too hard, it's about money, nobody really understands it except these guys, and we can't have a discussion about it. And I think that's why sometimes we often don't do policy comparisons. Our normal kind of methods of policy making seem to kind of fall by the wayside. And I think there is something about this debate where everyone's gone, the chance of dipped his toe in the water, it's too difficult, it's tax policy anyway, so that's hard. step away, whereas really we need to say there isn't a perfect option, it is really difficult, we definitely need to do something, and you know, let's think about what we can do.
Absolutely. Thank you. There's a lady in the with the microphone, yes.
Hello. I'm not sure I need the microphone. So I'm self-employed, and whilst I totally agree with everything that Kate was saying about exploitation of people who do not necessarily want to be, I am self-employed by choice. And I do think that there is a lot of value in people being self-employed, in the, you know, companies has, that doesn't know whether they have a job, whether the job role is actually there, that, you know, that's what I'm where I'm working at the moment. It's almost a proof of concept. And actually, from my point of view, I want the flexibility. I want to be able to learn different things, work for different employers. It seems to me that all we've heard so far is that self-employment from pretty every much angle is a bad thing. From, you know, from a taxation point of view, from a kind of employment rights point of view. I was just kind of wondering, you know, the things that worry me are that I don't get any sick pay, that I don't get any, you know, if I get called up on jury service, I'm screwed. You know, I think... Is there, I was wondering what sort of people had for ideas to, you know, help the anxiety, help sort of the problems that self-employed people have without being so sort of overwhelmingly negative about it?
Chris, I think that's a really important point. I think, and it's definitely not the case that self-employed is bad. I mean, my dad's a self-employed person with a white van. So self-employment is definitely not bad. There is clearly a huge value in self-employment. I think the issue is really about what does the tax system want to do about it? So I'm going to park to the side things about employment rights. I'll let Kate come back to that. I think there are things we could probably do to make self-employed people's lives easier, including around parental benefits, for example. Let me park that. I mean, what I'd say is, imagine there was a world in which there was a level tax playing field. So no matter how you earned your money, you got the same tax rate. And then say, do we want to give a lower tax rate to self-employed people? And why might you want to do that? Well, in general, I'd say, you don't want to give them a lower tax rate just because they're self-employed. I mean, that doesn't make much sense. There might be things you do want to target, like if people really are entrepreneurial and they're, you know, creating new innovations. But we need to actually target, what is it we want to encourage? And let's design a tax system that really encourages us that. And I said, it might be to do with startups and giving startups a bit of a boost. It might be to do with innovation. It might be to do with poor people. But currently, we don't target anything. I mean, the way I've started thinking about it is that it's like you go into your garden, you see a pot plant isn't doing very well. You know, okay, so you apply some fertiliser, but you fertilise the entire garden. And then not only have you helped that pot plant, you've created all sorts of other problems in the rest of the system because now you've got plants that are over-fertilised and you've got a lot of money doing it. So I think self-employment is great and we definitely shouldn't discourage it. I think the government should definitely not stop people being self-employed, but I think we should pause for thought before we try to use that system to sort of give tax breaks to self-employed people, unless we can really justify that that's a group that deserves a tax break. And I'd rather see those tax breaks shared more widely. But yeah, self-employment's not bad.
Okay. Well, we weren't trying to imply that kind of self-employment is inherently negative either, although just listening to Helen, I realised my dad is self-employed and he's an artist, which has often seemed like a terrible, terrible career choice. So maybe that's like implicitly influencing what I'm saying. I mean, I think we also have been campaigning quite hard to kind of improve rights for the self-employed, to improve the ability to pay into a pension, improve access to parental benefits. We've long argued for equalising access to maternity and paternity pay, for example. And of course, you'd expect me to say this, but you know, trade unions have done a kind of good job, basically. We have many self-employed people represented as technicians, as musicians, and well, there is now an artists union, actually. It's our newest affiliate. And a long experience of kind of thinking, actually, about the collective ways they can do that. And I think our kind of main incentive, though, has been around the incentives for employers rather than the incentives for the self-employed themselves. And the fact that I do think the tax system, certainly at the moment, does encourage employers to push people into self-employment as a way of avoiding them giving them rights rather than as a way of giving them positive flexibility.
Thank you. Any more questions?
Hi, Kayleigh Hignall here from Citizens Advice. I was quite interested in the idea of the separation of tax systems and rights systems that was mentioned, and perhaps the complexity that brings. So at Citizens Advice, we help like nearly 200,000 people each year about employment rights, and a lot of the people who come to us are confused about their rights and don't know they exist, don't know what system they're in or status, and some are being exploited because of that. Does the panel think that we've got a future where people can actually understand tax and their employment rights, or should we be looking at alternative solutions, so much more in the enforcement space, for example? It feels like we've not got to a simplicity answer in any sense of the kind of meaning of the word. It feels like we're adding more complexity into it.
Sounds a very good point. I think we definitely should be at a point where people understand their taxes. And if they were not there, we are fundamentally failing. I mean, so I think, are we there now? No, clearly not. I mean, you know, you need an economics degree to understand some of this stuff. So I'm not at all surprised that people don't understand how some of these interact. And at the moment, we do have a nasty system that locks a lot of these tax issues and employment rights issues together in this big mess, and it's very hard to unpick it. So I think, you know, that's it's a problem right now. I think in an ideal solution, that would be much simpler, because, you know, what makes the current situation complicated? It's because, you know, how you're taxed differs very sharply depending on how you're organised, on your level of income, on the choices you make, on the kind of contracts you have, and it's just a big mess. If we move to a system where actually it didn't really matter how you worked, you were getting taxed in the same way, then you wouldn't have lots of these bizarre structures being set up, because they're only being set up for the tax difference. Take the differences away, and a lot of these things will just wash away. So I think, yes, we should get to a simpler system, and I think we can get to a world in which the tax system is, I mean, I don't think it'll ever be so simple that you can, you know, have five-year-olds understanding it, but I think we should be simple enough that people can genuinely understand the way in which the government is trying to take their income.
I just think this is an example of where one does need sort of better and clearer definitions. It sounds a bit sort of boring and mundane, but part of the problem with employment, either for employment law purposes or for tax purposes, the courts will take a whole range of factors into account. And, you know, some of them are a little bit arcane, like, you know, what control the employee or the self-employed person exercises over their job day to day. Well, even an economically very, very dependent person can nevertheless have a lot of day-to-day control over the way in which they do their job. So it's kind of a very difficult line to draw. And, you know, as I keep on saying, that means that, you know, unscrupulous sort of employers can, as it were, take a punt and, you know, push the boat out to the furthest extent. And there might be a good, you know, chance that they're not caught or the revenue can't sustain a sort of as a challenge against it. So I think whatever solution one comes to, one must really have much, much clearer and simpler criteria in the legislation, because they are always easier to enforce than kind of woolly ones.
Kate? I'm actually really torn on this question. So I started my job about a year ago, and I started thinking about it a year ago, and when I first looked at this, I was like, why don't we just align the descriptions of for tax and employment law? And I thought this would be so much simpler, and everyone would understand it, and it's crazy, why haven't we done that, basically? And the kind of more I look at it and think about it, I think, well, employment law in particular is really, really complicated. Is that actually going to work, and will it enable kind of the law to change, as it has actually done quite effectively to keep up with new forms of employment? So I would say I am still on the fence on that question, but I do think it might be one of those kind of the best is the enemy of the good solutions, and if we try and do it all at once, actually, we'll end up doing nothing, and we might be better with some of the kind of incremental reform, as you say, much better enforcement. And, you know, information is probably the weakest tool people have in the kind of policy kit, but it still is a tool, and it's still pretty feeble at the moment.
Good point. Thank you. There was another question somewhere.
Yes, hi, Ian McCluskey. I'm here as a Labour Party member. If we are to equalise the tax difference between employment and self-employment, would you raise the tax burden on the self-employed or reduce the tax burden on the employed? And if the latter, what tax decisions would you make to pay for it?
So I guess I'll start with that one. So I was point out that two things. One, nothing we've ever said in this whole debate for the last year has said anything about the tax level. I think genuinely how much tax you want to raise from people's incomes and how much you want to raise from the rich versus the poor is a political choice. So in nothing I've said do we say you have to, you know, hike up self-employed national insurance contributions to meet employees' rates. Now, the simple maths means that because there are just very many more employees than there are self-employed people, if you wanted to do something like meet halfway in the middle, that would be a revenue loser, I guess, probably what you're alluding to, because there are just so many more employees. I think if you really, and which you should, bring in company owner managers, then again, there's, you know, if you're trying to level their playing field, there's some more revenue there because they are getting much bigger tax breaks. I think the important point is we need, we need alignment across legal forms. Then we need to worry about how much money do we want to get from income taxes versus consumption taxes or property taxes. And this comes back to something that IFS is always banging on about the entire system. So, you know, if I was Chancellor, I wouldn't be changing all these taxes tomorrow and just hiking up rates for all sorts of reasons. But I would go for alignment, then choose the rate we want to get income from labour, and then think about the overall revenue burden. So I don't think there is one single answer to how you do it. I think it's going to be a combination of things.
Risk of being predictable, we'd obviously say the first principle would be start by equalising the rates for employers rather than for employees. It might possibly be politically easier. The one proposal I've seen on how to do that is Social Market Foundation put out something a while ago suggesting you could start with a hirer's rate and you could set out a predictable path whereby in 2018-19, for example, there'd be a 2% national insurance employers, right, keep going until you get to the and then I think it would be quite interesting to see how those kind of costs balanced out. Obviously, interesting to see about whether you want to therefore reduce employer nets at the same time so that you end up cost neutral or whether you want to raise more money. But I do think there's something about a predictable path, basically, and B, starting with employer first.
I think a slight note of controversy here. I think it's kind of fine if you can say who the hirer is. if we're talking about people who are, well, disguised employees or people who are on the borderline. So you've got, one big employer, the hirer or the employer, the sole customer in the background. You can say, or find a way of saying, no, we're going to charge you with the employer's national insurance anyway. I think it really is somewhat more difficult if there is no single hirer, if you have, a real genuine sort of self-employed person who's working for lots and lots of people. Because, I don't know how you would go about it. Would you say, well, okay, every time you buy anything, you've got to pay employers national insurance on the kind of labour element of that cost. I mean, that's what would be implied by going straight for alignment. So I think actually, conceptually probably, one should go straight for alignment. But actually, just to get there, in the case of people who don't have a single obvious hire is very, very hard. That's why I keep on going back to say you've got to kind of build up a lot of public understanding and support for what the issues are, so because there's going to be unpopular or difficult bits of almost any solution, and you won't make the people who suffer like it, but you will at least sort of create an atmosphere that there is no simple solution, and that it's going to be hard, and what the bigger picture actually is, as opposed to springing surprises on people all the time.
Maybe we can commission IFS to do a nice distributional analysis.
Well, in fact, we do have a distribution analysis, and we're about to start a piece of work looking about how you get to the ideal system, so watch this space.
Well, that may be a very good note on which to end, because sadly we've run out of time, but thank you all very much.